This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers. Yeah.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk about the best of questions we get from the seminars, emails, our hotline. And we recently came back from the OPM conference, and we got some pretty good questions there. Now, who better to be here than John Elliott, federal benefit strategist, fellow seminar presenter, retired Fed. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
And it's just the two of us, and Dorothy, the ever-efficient engineer, and we're here to take your calls. We're at 877-936-9333, 877-936-9333. 9333. Remember now, though, it's 10:06 Eastern Time, Monday. What is today? May 10th. And we are on till about 10:58. So if you're not listening at this time, don't call in because nobody's going to answer the phone. But you can email us at foryourbenefit@nitpinc.com. What's NITP? It's a pre-retirement, mid-career, beginning career, knower of all things federal, seminar presenter. 27 years in business. We don't sell anything. We don't farm emails. All we do is present retirement seminars to the agencies.
Right.
Okay, let's have at it. Can I go first, John?
Sure.
Because you are the benefits person, and this, I think, straddles both of what we do. I'm kind of a finance tax type. And this year, when you talk about best dates in the year to retire, oftentimes, and it isn't guaranteed to be the best date for everybody, people tend towards the end of the calendar year if they're FERS in December 31st or the 1st, 2nd, or 3rd of January if they're CSRS. Generally. But isn't this year got a quirk in it that probably for everybody it's December 31st?
Yeah, it's just the way the calendar breaks. December 31st is a Friday. Therefore, the 1st and 2nd would be a Saturday and Sunday. Well, typically you don't get paid for a weekend. So even for CSRS, first December 31st is always the most popular date with good reason. But this year for CSRS as well, it'll be December 31st because you could retire on Monday the 3rd and get paid for Monday the 3rd, but one day of pay generally does not make up for 3 days loss of annuity. What do I mean by 3 days loss of annuity? Well, if you retire on the 3rd, your annuity will begin on the 4th, but you only get 1 day's pay, which we figured out will not make up for 3 days loss of annuity. So that's why December 31st, 2010, is generally the best date, with one caveat for the CSRS folks. If by retiring on Saturday the 1st, even though you don't get paid, and then your annuity would begin the 2nd, would get you one more month of service. You're 1 day shy of adding another month to your lifetime annuity computation, then you might want to go Saturday the 1st. And you'd only have 1 day loss of annuity, big deal. But for a lifetime of an extra month in your annuity computation, I would certainly go the 1st. But that's a minority. Just statistically, it has to be a minority of people. So generally, we're saying for CSRS and FERS, December 31st.
Okay, there's an issue with the leave year this year as well, too. Doesn't the leave year end kind of early?
I expect it's going to end January 1st.
Yeah.
Be the last day of the leave year.
So we kind of got to use-lose that gets
well, you could
the
go the first. As long as you go before the start of the new leave year, which would be Sunday the 2nd, you would cash out all your annual leave above 240. the use or lose portion. So if you had 370 hours of annual leave, you'd cash out all 370 hours.
And this is good because the reason, again, this comes out of class, I would say more often than not, in the classes I teach, and I don't even teach benefits. People said, you know, John said December 31st is best for FERS, or January 1st, 2nd, or 3rd for CSRS, or, yeah, or Tammy, or Bob, or da-da-da.
Right.
And I go, I don't think they said that as an overall statement. I believe that that would be the best date, given use, lose, leave. But
well, there are three reasons, and they all attach to annual leave. One is you can, a lot of people like to work throughout the whole year, save up as much leave as they can during the full 12-month period, and therefore get paid for more money. So that's one reason. The other reason, second reason, there are three. Second reason is a lot of people like the idea of being taxed on that annual leave in the new tax year. If you went in December or the end of November, you'd receive the payment in December. Therefore, it'd be a taxable in the current year. But by going, you won't get that payment till 2-3 weeks into January if you go at the end of December, early January. So therefore, it'll be taxed in the next year. That's reason two. A lot of people like that, which makes some sense. From your perspective,
a ton of sense. A deferred,
okay.
Even if
exactly.
It's in the same bracket, it's a deferred tax is the best type of tax.
Exactly. And the third reason, and this is the hardest to explain, but it's the law. It's been true for years. Is that even though you've retired, say on December 31st, your payroll office, who pays this out to you, is required by law to treat this as if you were actually using your annual leave vacation time. So they have to pay you at the new higher pay adjusted rate, say effective January 2nd, even though you're gone. That's the law. It's been the law for years. And so that's the third and final reason why people like the end of the year, because most, sometimes all, depending on how the calendar breaks, will be paid at the newer high or pay adjusted rate as opposed to your current hourly rate. So that's the third reason why people like the end of the year. It all makes sense. Those are three good reasons to go at the end of the year. I went in the middle of the year, but I didn't care. But they are good reasons to go at the end of the year. I could have waited 6 months and done the same thing. I just didn't want to. But
okay, let me take a little tangent here. Some listeners are saying, "Oh, you guys are wrong. The tax rates in 2011 are going to skyrocket." Now, in fact, they are scheduled to skyrocket, but they were scheduled 7 years ago to go up. I finally drilled down and I Googled enough things and I found in the proposed budget what the new administration would want the tax rates to be, and I was very happy to see, and in some cases, they're lower for somebody that has a ton of accumulated leave. Not much, but a little bit lower, but they're not going to go just vertical, and for those that would be hit hard, it's those with taxable incomes with very high numbers, close to $200,000. And a taxable income is all your income minus all your deductions. Now, in fact, somebody could have eons of accumulated leave and be up there. But for the bulk of people, if it is taxed in the next year, it'd be no worse, potentially a little bit better. But generally speaking, I'd say it'd be no worse. Just side comment. All righty. So that's a question that comes to me in class, and I'm sure you touch on it too.
It's the most commonly asked question we get in emails. Sure, certainly. And if we didn't address it during the course of the class, which we do as part of the seminar, we talk about this, we'd get a lot of questions in class, but we cover it in class, so hence they don't have too many questions. But we do get a lot of emails, what's the best date to retire? If I had to pick one question we get more than any other, it would be best date.
Yeah. Okay, now let's go over on your side of the net. We were on both sides of the net here. Here I'm lost. The decision to take Part B
Medicare at 65.
What is Part B Medicare?
To be or not to be, that is the question.
Okay.
And that's, I would say, the second most frequent question I get in emails. And that's much harder to noodle through because it's highly individualized. What does that mean? It means it depends on your circumstances. What I'd say, if you've got some health issues, or you're overweight or obese, or you smoke, or you ride motorcycle, do dangerous things, don't exercise. Even though your current health may be okay, if you have these high risk factors, you have to decide at 65 whether you want Part B or not. Otherwise, you start getting hit with 10% per year penalties for each year you delay. And there's a caveat to that, which we need to talk about in a minute, that just surfaced. But then I would take Part B, because what does Part B get you? Well, you end up with no out-of-pocket medical expenses when you're retired and taking Part B. In combination with your federal employee health benefits plan, you end up with zero out-of-pocket medical expenses. So that's the advantage of taking Part B. But if you don't have significant health problems, or your lifestyle is pretty good, maybe not perfect, but pretty good, you certainly don't smoke, your weight is in, you know, within reasonable control, and you only go to the doctor once or twice a year, you know, and your copay is $20, so you're spending maybe $40 if you go twice a year, and you're paying at least $96.40 a month, why would you take Part B? And that's a legitimate question. Unfortunately, you can't predict what your health is going to be in the future, and you've got these 10% a year penalties. Okay. Well, they just made it a little more complicated, or maybe a little easier, depending on your point of view. OPM has got this pilot program where they're going to pay for, I guess, the $96.40 part of the premium. If you're in a higher income, you pay over that, but they'll pay for some people the whole Part B premium, as near as I can tell. And if you're in a higher category, they'll pay that portion, that $96.40. And it's called a sub option. What they're going to do, OPM, is they send out letters to their federal health benefits carriers every year, and they negotiate coverage and cost with the carriers. As part of this, they're going to have, you know, ask if they want to have this sub option, which allows people to go to Part B. The premium, I guess, will be paid by the carrier, but they also benefit for you taking Part B. The difference is you won't get the advantage of having the medical expenses paid for. You'll still be on the hook for medical expenses. There'll be, but what it looks like is that you could then later on, if you need the regular Part B, where you go to zero out-of-pocket medical expenses, you'll be able to do so, and thereby, because you're already in Part B, avoiding the 10% penalties. That's the way it looks. And we'll wait and see. So, and I just read this again at the, just to refresh my memory of it, at the NARF magazine, National Association of Active and Retired Federal Employees magazine. Their latest issue discusses this. It's a good deal. Yeah. And it'd be perfect for somebody like me who doesn't have, only maybe one health risk factor, not too bad, and is in good health and has a good family history. So if all this is on board next year, when I have to take decide, I wasn't going to take Part B until this. Now I'm thinking, if this program's in place for me next year when I turn 65, I will probably take advantage of it.
Okay, you reference in our notes here Walt Francis's Checkbook Guide to Healthcare Plans.
Yeah.
And Walt discusses this and that, and as well as one of the archive shows on And you can go to nitpinc.com, left-hand side of the homepage, for your benefit radio show, and just scroll back and you can listen to it 24/7. Now, did Walt talk about this as well?
Well, we didn't know the pilot program.
Mm-hmm.
No, because on November 9th, I think when he was on, this wasn't an issue. It was not known at the time. This is fairly recent, in the last month or two. So even we did an April 5th show. We, Tammy Flanagan and I, and a lawyer who deals with Medicare, very knowledgeable lady, and we batted around the pros and cons of taking Part B. But even on April 5th, we didn't know about this pilot program. So it's been in the last month, and more details to follow. So some of what we may be guessing at how it's going to work, we hope by next open season there will be plans, if not all of them, some of them, where you can choose this, what they call sub-option, that I just described. But as of April 5th, we didn't even know it. So you can listen to those shows, and they're good to listen to for the rest of the Part B discussion, but not this particular issue.
Okay. Now we'll hit the ball over on this side of the fence. TSP, transfer of funds into the TSP, not from one's compensation, but we talk about this in class, and people are very surprised that you can transfer funds outside of your compensation. In other words, traditional IRAs or 401k plans from a prior employer, etc., into the TSP. Now, this is not a figment of our imagination. There's a form for this, TSP 60. But what's very crucial here is if you're transferring in traditional IRA funds, they have to be taxable. You can't transfer in the non-taxable traditional IRA funds. Notice
I'm in other words, the contributions you made to, say, your IRA.
Years ago, but then, you know, they changed the law so that you couldn't deduct them. So it would be the delta between what was put in there, like you say, that you couldn't deduct, and the total value of what it's worth.
Yeah, I just did that for my wife.
Okay.
I got the what they call cost basis, and you can get that either from through your financial planner, or you can go directly to the IRA fund, and they'll send it to you. And what does that mean? It's a whole sheet of your history of earnings and contributions. So once you get that, you just go all your contributions, and that you would want to retain in your IRA, but transfer all the rest, and we hope that's a majority of your money. That mm-hmm. means your IRA's been doing well over the years. And if you've had it a number of years, it should be. The majority of the funds then go into the TSP. Now, why would you do that? Well, one, the trading management fees at the TSP are the lowest anywhere. And don't tell me about Vanguard. Even the founder of Vanguard says, no, we cannot beat the TSP as far as low management fees. So that's one reason. The other reason is for the CERS people who have voluntary contribution accounts. If you have a conventional IRA, and actually you gave me this advice, I'll turn it over to you. I can explain it because I just went through it, so it's fresh in my mind. I can explain it, but
I'll do it quick then, because this could take forever. But those NCSRS or CSRS offset that do not owe a redeposit can put up to 10% of their federal lifetime earnings into something called the Voluntary Contribution Program. Upon retirement, they have two choices. Leave it with OPM. The money goes to OPM, paid a decent rate of interest in today's environment while it's in there. And then at retirement, they can leave it there and receive a greater annuity, or they can transfer it directly into a Roth IRA. 10% of somebody's lifetime federal earnings. Now, here's the catch. It gets caught with something called the aggregation rules. Sometimes I affectionately call it the aggravation rules. That it looks not only at the money coming from the voluntary contribution into the Roth, but it also looks at all the traditional IRAs, even though they may not be touched to go into the Roth. And you have to make a calculation as to what's taxable and what's not. However, if you strip away the taxable portion of the traditional IRAs and move it into the TSP, then 100% of all the money, both in the traditional at that point as well as the voluntary contribution, other than the interest earnings, would be non-taxable and could move into the Roth. You make a very good point, too, is, well, why would I want to put it into the TSP? Investment opportunities, because it makes a good rate of return and the investment fees are low. Somebody out there saying, I can beat the TSP. Well, if they can, please call. We want to get your phone number. And the point being is, maybe it just has to stay in there for a year.
Yeah.
And then pull it back out in a year. Can you pull money out of the TSP while you're in federal service? Yeah, if you're what? 59 and a half or over? Is that the age? There's some age requirement.
Yes. If you're in, you mean while you're still federally mm-hmm. employed? Yes. It's called in-service withdrawal. You can take, once you're 59 and a half, a lot of people are still working at that age. You can take your money out just as if you were retired. Not a good idea, but you can do it.
Yeah. It's a bad idea,
but you can do it.
This is just to facilitate getting money into the Roth. And then the last issue is, and I understand this is true, you cannot transfer money into the TSP if you're taking monthly payments from it. I understand there's a barrier to that, but that would only probably apply to somebody in retirement, potentially years into retirement.
Yeah, I'll back off that. If your intention, I was thinking, oh, you're going to take it and start spending the money before you retire, which is never a good idea, obviously. But I suppose if you're going to just put it in either a conventional or Roth IRA while you're working, sure, you're still investing in growing your retirement fund, and that would be fine if that's your choice.
Okay. All righty. We covered that, and I'm looking at your topics. How do I get the 1.1% under FERS? What is 1.1% of what?
I'm getting that a lot frequently. For some reason in emails, all of a sudden I'm getting, you know, how do I get 1.1%? Well, what do they mean by that? They know that the regular FERS rate is 1.0% for each year and month of service times your high three average salary. But if you can manage to last till you're 62 and have at least 20 years of service and then retire, you get a little more, 1.1%. Now, that doesn't sound like a big deal, but, you know, I can add, depending on where your annuity is, if you work 30 years and under FERS and retire at 62 instead of 1.0 or 30,000, if your high three is 100,000, you'd get 33,000, 3,000 more a year. So it can add a couple 3,000 depending on what your annuity is each year. And that was put in the law when FERS was created to just encourage people to hang around till 62. Now, I got a question the other day, which was kind of interesting. And it's not a bad question because, you know, most people don't know this stuff, and that's why we're here. He said, I'd like to retire in January, but I won't be 62 till February. Can I retire and then not have the effective date of my retirement till February so I can, when I turn 62, so I can get the 1.1%? You can't. You have to retire at 62 with at least 20 years of service. It's just that simple. So, but that's been a fairly common question recently, at any rate, that I get.
I got a question at this OPM conference, and they didn't know they were asking the wrong person, because I'm a finance person. And the question was, I have 10 years of federal service, but if I redeposit money, I'll get another 10 years towards my eligibility to retire. It's not going to increase their annuity. So they had 10 years, and that's what the annuity would be based on. But if they redeposited whatever this thing was, it would give them another 10 years towards the 20-year minimum to retire. And I'm probably misstating it because yeah. You're looking at me like, did you talk to somebody from Mars, Bob?
No. This was a FERS person?
Mm-hmm.
Well, because of a law change, and this is in last October, FERS people who took money out of the fund, that 0.8% of you were contributing every 2 weeks because you left the government. Heretofore, before the law changed, you could come back, but you could never redeposit that money. So you would have lost that 10 years, and you'd only start building your annuity going forward. Now, thank goodness, you can now redeposit that money with interest and buy all that time back. And it is very cost effective to do so. If you do the math, and it's not hard to do, any time you can buy back your time that you wouldn't get in your annuity computation, not to mention eligibility for retirement, you'll quickly make up that money, even with the interest that you hand over to OPM in future annuity payments. That's why I say it's cost effective to do so. So that's really, if somebody says, and I had a couple questions since the law change, is it really a good idea to pay that redeposit? The answer is really easy. Yes, it is a good idea. You should do it. You should find the money and do it.
Okay.
Particularly if it's 10 extra years of service.
That's a lot of years.
Yeah, but even if it's one extra, even if it was 1 year or a few months, it's cost effective.
All righty. Back to the TSP. I don't want to talk totally about the TSP, but I get more questions about the TSP probably than anything else tax-wise or finance-wise that I talk about. And one of the things I get in class, but sometimes more often, are the emails through our email service. And the individual says, I'd like to take a lump sum out of the TSP. I'm retiring, and I'd like to put it as a down payment on my home. And this is more, I think, psychological than it is economic. The psychological part is, I don't want a big mortgage payment. Mm-hmm. However, I think a lot of people forget that 100% of the money that's inside of the TSP has never seen the light of taxation, such that if it's taken out, it's going to get hit with tax. Now, let's just say that that kind of money coming out probably would be hit with a 25 or 28% federal rate, and if they have a state rate, put another 5% on that. So in other words, they're going to take the proverbial haircut on this. The money's really going to get skinny down. So the assumption that they're going to take out X and be able to put X down on the house isn't true. It's going to be X minus the taxes. So usually what I've suggested is, why don't you go on a monthly distribution from the TSP equal to roughly what the additional mortgage would be? Is the TSP taxable? Yes, those monthly payments. Is the interest on the higher mortgage deductible? Yes. Now, this gets into some finer points that I will not get into, but I think that's the initial response. Leave the money in the TSP to grow and only take out what you need to get away from that psychology. Have it done electronically, and your hands don't shake when you write the mortgage payment. So the money comes in, and electronically the money comes out of your bank account to pay the mortgage. But I don't think I'd take a huge chunk of my TSP to put as a down payment on a house just for the psychological comfort of not having a mortgage payment. Anyway.
Yeah, and also you're investing in real estate. I can almost hear the audience laughing because it hasn't been a very good investment of late. But it may be again someday. It's never been as good as the stock market at over time, but it may rebound someday where at least you're investing in something. You're taking money, sure, from your TSP, maybe as you suggest in monthly payments, and paying a mortgage, but, you know, you end up with something, plus a place to live.
Yeah. All righty. Let's go over to the benefit side, and this is question or discussion topic 4. Most of the retirement questions are directed to employees with 30 or more years of service. At age 59, an individual will have 20 years of service, and at what age would that individual receive a better retirement? Age 60 or 62?
Well, 62, because the simple answer is the longer you work, the more money you get. What this person, this was a first person, and what he or she was wondering is, apparently she knew, well, if she didn't, I explained in my answer, that at 60, because she has 20 years, she could get an annuity unreduced for age. If she went at 59, there'd be a reduction, 5% for each year she was under 62. So she didn't want that. I think she already knew that, but there would be an advantage to working till 62 beyond the obvious. One, she'd get the 1.1% kicker that we talked about earlier, and she could go apply for Social Security. So, in general, I think if you're FERS particularly, if you can work till 62, you're better off than going earlier. Now, if you have to go earlier because you got a nice job in the private sector, that's good reason to go. But absent that, it's generally better to wait till 62 if you're FERS. That's kind of how the system was set up 23 years ago.
All righty, I'm going to go off our notes, if you will, and ask you this. It's not a question that's technical. It's a question more of change in times. I get this question in class that I didn't get 3 years ago. I'm not so sure I want to leave. My job's okay or better. I like it. And years ago, people couldn't wait to get out because they could go to private industry and make more money, or they just wanted to retire. Well, the prior 3 years with regards to the financial happenings and what it may or may not have done to one's thrift or other investments maybe changed that a little bit. And somebody says, I need to work a few more years to build up what I lost. Do you hear that in class?
Oh, I hear a lot of, I like my job, I like the work I do, and then I tell them, well, don't be in a hurry to retire. Also, I hear, I'm going to have to work a lot longer because of the recent bad stock market. And that's a good idea, particularly if you're FERS. If you're CSRS, which is, yes, you have taken a hit in your investments, but most CSRS and offset people, if they put in their 30, but certainly by the time you hit 35 years, if you want to retire for whatever reason, you can afford to retire, I'm convinced.
That's a great point. I've brought this up on air before. I got this call, maybe it was a year ago, and this individual was very distraught, but had a good number of years, 35 or 40, under their belt as a CSRSer, and they mm-hmm. lost $40,000 in the TSP. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not going to make light of that. They lost $40,000, but I think they were the old donut in the hole. They were concentrating on the hole, and they said, I've lost $40,000. I'm going to have to work. And I go, no, I'm not going to make light of your loss. You'll have less, but it's not going to affect your annuity any. You're going to be retiring on 70 or 80% of your highest compensation, and you won't have certain things withheld, so you probably have more disposable income than you had
as you approach 40 years. You probably will have more net annuity pay than net paycheck pay.
Yeah.
So you're right. And true, if you stay in the government, you can still contribute to the TSP and help a little bit of the recovery, but
it's not going to change the lifestyle.
And it isn't. If you stay invested in the TSP, you'll recover over time anyway, and if you didn't bail out of the stock market when the tough times hit in 08 or even, then you've probably recovered a big chunk of it, even if you were retired. That is my case. I was retired, and I didn't pull out of the stock market, and of course, from March of 2009 even to current, I've recovered most of what I lost.
And as I look up at the monitors, the market's on fire today. It's up 360-some-odd points. But everybody looks at today like today is the only day. Yeah, it's up 360. Last week it had a hiccup for whatever reason. And like you say, over time. All righty, let's go back over to benefit side. And question, reserve retirement versus active duty retirement.
Yeah, it's another fairly frequent question. You get credit for any active duty time you spent in the military, And I had a question the other day. This person's going to get a reserve retirement at age 60. He said, will that impact or reduce my FERS annuity? And the answer would be the same as SERS. No, it won't. If you're getting a reserve retirement, which you start drawing at age 60, your FERS, SERS annuity will not be touched, and vice versa. You can collect your full reserve retirement, your full FERS, SERS annuity. So I get that's a fairly frequent question. What this guy, and he was a fairly high-ranking official at State Department who asked this question, and he had just come into the government recently. He was going to get a reserve retirement. He was 57. In 3 years, he could start drawing his reserve retirement. But I said, presumably, you have some active duty service in that mix, too. He said, yeah, I have about 8 years. I said, well, that's you want to pay the eight-year military deposit for that 8 years of active duty.
How much would that cost?
Well, it depends. It depends on depends on how much he made when he's in the military on active duty. But it's for FERS, it's 3% of whatever he made plus interest.
Is the interest rate high?
Well, it varies from year to year. I mean, lately the interest rates have been pretty low, as you know. But the interest rate depends on what OPM gets in their Treasury securities investments. So the previous year's yield is what drives that year's interest rate. So it's a variable rate, and it's been varying. It's been a variable rate since about 1985. So, but it's a good idea to pay for that military for that 8 years. But then he said, well, if I pay the active duty, and this is not the first time I got that question, will that reduce my reserve retirement? I said, no, and because it's true, no. So the answer is you should pay for your active duty time, and it won't affect your reserve retirement at all, and it's just you'll just get more FERS or SERS annuity, and you'll still collect your full reserve retirement at age 60. So he was quite happy to hear that, and he said, I'm going to go straight to my HR office and start the process to pay for that 8 years of active duty time. Reserve, you can't pay for. Reserve time, you can't pay for.
Okay. This brings to mind some of the comments made in class. The bulk of what we do is pre-retirement. Certainly, we do a significant number of mid-career and a smaller number of beginning career, although our TSP seminar is very popular. But I'm seeing people in the pre-retirement course that are in their late 20s or early 30s. And to the person, I almost go up at the break without trying to be insulting, saying, what are you doing in here? As an inquisitive thing, not like, what are you doing in here? And to the person, it's, I don't want to make the same mistakes that some of my colleagues have made, and I want to hear now what I want to hear now rather than hear it 25 years from now when I can't do anything about it.
And they're very smart.
Yes.
Very smart to do that. And look, frequently these pre-retirement, which is our major audience, that's where... And that's because agencies have so much training money and they concentrate on people closer to retirement. Well, the problem is, and that sometimes shuts out the younger people that could really benefit, and I'm talking FERS, obviously, where they could really benefit by learning about this stuff much, much earlier. I mean, I would encourage... Any, if you can get in one as soon as you get in the federal government, particularly if you're young, if you can get in a class, even a pre-retirement class, don't be fooled by the name, and your agency will let you in because there's room. By all means, you want to do that. And the last seminar I did, I had three or four very young, obviously very young people. And the only thing they weren't interested in is the Medicare stuff. So, but all the other stuff was relevant to them. So what I ended up doing, because they were interested in the TSP stuff, I flip-flopped that with Medicare and said, yeah, I understand at your age, you don't want to hear about Medicare. There's no reason you should hear, because who knows what it'll be like when you are 65. So they left. They got the TSP stuff and left, and then the majority of class stayed at the end to hear the Medicare portion. The young people will get a lot out of it, and particularly the thrift savings plan. They've got to know. They got to give till it hurts each pay period, as much as they can, if not the yearly max. Certainly to get the 5% match, they need to do at least 5% of their salary. So they need to know these things. And it's good to know that they're going to have a defined benefit that is a FERS annuity someday. And I suppose it's not as crucial that they hear about Social Security at this point, but that's the third leg of their retirement. Can't hurt. As I say, the only thing they probably don't need to hear about at their tender age is Medicare, because who knows how that's going to end up. And if it doesn't change much in the next 30 or 40 years, which I doubt, then, they can take a pre-retirement course and get the Medicare stuff.
And I had one come up, again, somebody like that, and they were very young, and they said, well, you talk about maximizing the thrift and flexible spending. After a while, somebody runs out of money. So I said, listen, this is just I don't know this person from Adam, but if you're in a field where you may be very young and you're looking at a robust salary downstream, max out the thrift to the matching point. Then after that, I'd put the money into a Roth. You don't get any tax deduction, but at that level of income, your tax deduction won't mean near as much as it will when you kick the thrift in later on.
And in 2011, there will be a Roth option in the TSP, so you can do that. And that would be an excellent idea. And I always maintained that if when I started in government, there was no FERS. I was halfway through my federal career before FERS became available. But if I had been able to do 30 years under FERS and contributed as much, in many years would have been the maximum to the TSP, certainly in later years, I would have been wealthier than I am now. So FERS is a good system the longer you're in it and the longer you contribute to TSP. Now, if you should leave the government because you want to go in the private sector, you can still continue and absolutely should in either a 401k at your new company or an IRA or Roth IRA as well. So, but yeah, that's the key, is contribute to the TSP and start building up the miracle of compounding interest. If you have children just starting out, either in the public or private sector, encourage them to sack away as much as they can in the TSP or their 401k.
All righty, just a tax note. This was a change, I think, 2 years ago, that public safety officers, sometimes called PSO, public, P, safety, S, officer, O, get to deduct another $3,000 against their annuity should they be retired, to the extent that they have health insurance. And it's somewhat of a manual, if you use a program, you need to be aware that you would almost have to manually put it in there and tell the program that you're a public safety officer. And I'm not so sure everybody catches that. So it's an additional $3,000 deduction over and above what your deduction would normally be on your annuity. Again, this is for public safety officers. I said service, it's safety officers. All righty. Question 10 on your sheet, John. Somebody was very kind to say some nice things about it, but did have a question. And the question is there a penalty under FERS if you retire prior to age 65, even if you have 20 years of service?
Well, for him, there wasn't, because he was past 62. And I forget what age, I think he may have been 64 when he asked this question recently. And no, there is not. The only age reduction penalty under FERS is if he retires on, and not him, but somebody retires on what they call a minimum retirement age plus 10. What does that mean? It means once you reach your minimum retirement age, which can range from 55 to 57, depending on your year of birth, and you have at least 10 years of service, you can retire and get an immediate annuity, but that annuity is reduced 5% for each year you're under 62, prorated monthly. Now, you can postpone that annuity and start drawing it whenever you want. That's the only time you can do that is an MRA plus 10 and reduce the age reduction if you wish. But other than that, there's no age reduction penalty, and there certainly wasn't for him because he was past 60, and or 62 in his case, and he could retire right now. He said he had 20 plus years, so he could retire, get the 1.1% kicker because he was 62 plus and had at least 20 years of service. So that was his situation. So that was the answer. He had probably, and this is tough on people. I understand why I asked the question, because you talk to people and somebody will say, well, I heard there's this age reduction, but then he may have been talking to somebody who's 56, who has less than 30 years of service and is looking to retire and was told they'd have this age reduction. They had 30 years at 56, they'd have no age reduction either. But so he said, well, is there one for me then? No, not for him, but maybe the younger person in his office he talked to. And that adds to the confusion or the uncertainty. So I understand why we get these questions. They're perfectly appropriate, and people like him should be asking these questions. You should never hesitate to ask a question for fear of you sounding silly, or there's no such thing as a silly question. It's a cliche, but it's also true. It's true of anything in life. There's no such thing as a silly question, certainly not in our field.
And I always tell people when they say that, I say, listen, this is what I do, I have done all my life. If you were to tell me what you do, I'd be lost in 30 minutes.
Right.
And we all live somewhat in a world of specialization. Right. All right, another kind of mid-career, maybe beginning career seminar. An individual goes to work for Uncle, leaves federal service, had established a thrift savings account, and they come back in. They tried private industry. They left for whatever reason. Let's not try to figure out why they left, but they did. And now they come back. They had not touched the thrift. They had not touched their money in the fund. How do they revive the thrift? Are they entitled to revive it and go back in and put new money in with the old?
Yes. Certainly. Yeah, once they return to the federal service, they can reactivate that account. And I think I don't know the exact payroll function, but there's a code that probably is transmitted to the thrift board, thrift and service office, and it reactivates your account, and you can certainly start making contributions out of your paycheck again.
Okay.
All you have to be is a federal employee covered under FERS, CERS, or CERS offset, and you can make contributions to your TSP. Even if you're retired and come back as a reemployed annuitant, as long as you're not you're covered under FERS or CERS offset, or CERS and CERS offset, you can resume contributions as well.
Great. So here's another question. Often in class, it's not necessarily a question. A comment somebody makes is, yeah, but you're forgetting one thing with the thrift. It's federally guaranteed. And I go, well, yes, if your money's all in the G fund. Yes, partially in the F fund. Outside of that, other than the L funds, I'm not so sure. As a matter of fact, it's not. C fund is not. I fund is not. S fund is not. Some of the F fund is. Certainly all the G fund is. And the L funds have a mixture of it, so it's kind of hard.
They use all five of the funds, so... Yeah.
I guess the one closest to one's retirement's probably got more G in it than one furthest from retirement.
Right.
Anyway, it's just there's this common misconception with that, as well as the annuity program. The annuity program, now we're not talking about the high three, we're not talking about federal service, we're talking about the purchased annuity with thrift funds. That's done through a private company called Metropolitan Life. Now, there is a guarantee, as I understand it, that somebody, if they were to buy the annuity today and unfortunately pay us tomorrow, they'd at least be paid what they put in. I understand that. I can't say that with 100% certainty.
Well, there are...
There are options to buy.
There are options to buy where you can protect your TSP account if you die in an untimely fashion, but they reduce your annuity payment.
Sure.
Yeah, there are two methods to do that. But, yes, that can be purchased.
Okay, now let's...
It's not... I've started to get the question, is it a good time to buy an annuity? And I would argue there's rarely a good time to buy an annuity, but right now with interest rates at a low 3.75%, it's a particularly bad time. Now, I will never purchase, I haven't done anything with my TSP account, I just left it alone to continue being invested and so forth. But the last thing I'll probably ever do is purchase an annuity, unless, God forbid, we go back to those inflation years of 12%, then it might get my attention. But until then, and we hope we don't go back to that, no, it's...
I'd agree with you.
Yeah. And most financial planners that we have in our seminars that we've talked to on this show are kind of the same mind.
Although, I remember this vividly. It was 11, maybe 12 years ago. Individual calls up. Individual worked for uncle, is an engineer. Engineers are generally very good managing their money. I think I've told this story before. And I said, what are you going to do with the thrift? Put it into an IRA and play with it? And the response was, no, I'm going to buy the MetLife annuity. My response was, why would you do that? It only pays 7.3% interest. Effectively, that's what it pays. This person was in good health. And I'll never forget that conversation, because today they bought an annuity that pays 7.3% interest. Can't find that today. So you're right. As interest rates go up, these become more attractive as interest
exactly.
rates. Unless you're very old at retirement, then sometimes you get a better deal.
And I should explain that the interest rate is locked in. So if you purchase an annuity this month with your TSP account, the interest rate is at 3.75%. And that locks you in. So the where you get the most annuity is you're older when you start the annuity. Of course, the amount of your account balances drives it, but also the interest rate in effect the month you purchase the annuity.
Okay, John, Dorothy's given us the high sign. Final comments?
I would never retire without taking a retirement seminar. And there are a lot of people who apparently do, because of the questions I get from retirees. They couldn't have possibly taken our retirement seminar and asked some of these questions.
Okay. Now, without sounding self-serving, or at a minimum, listen to this show every week.
Yes.
And that doesn't cost a penny.
No, it does, but it doesn't cost... Your agency pays for your retirement seminar, typically.
Oh, okay. Thank you, John. That was a very good summary. Mine, watch out for your investment profile. Monitor what you get. Just don't put it in a drawer and say, I'm afraid to look at it. Don't be spooked by tax rates going through the roof. And listen to the show. And we'll be back next week. And I wish I had a memory long enough to tell you who's going to be on next week. But we will be on. Have a nice week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.